Continuing with Keith Lowe's Savage Continent, Europe in the Aftermath of World War II, the Soviet Solution. When the Soviets reinvaded Ukraine and Poland in 1944 and discovered the extent of the ethnic conflict there, they were alarmed. They certainly couldn't allow such chaos to disrupt their supply lines while the war was still going on. And since the UPA had also begun to attack Soviet formations, something had to be done to stabilize the situation. And if you did not hear last week's show, this portion of the show, our reading portion, was a long interjection, a long comment on that paragraph. Continuing, their solution was simple. If the different nationalities could not be made to live together peacefully, the way that's phrased is so annoying to me. It just makes me kind of twisting my seat a little bit here. If the different nationalities could not be made to live together peacefully on the same territory, then they should be separated, the daddy tells us. This separation was to be done on a statewide scale. The Poles should live in Poland, and the Ukrainians should live in a Ukrainian Soviet Socialist Republic. The demarcation line between the two would not be the old Polish border from the 1930s. It would be moved westwards so that most of what Ukrainians regarded as Western Ukraine would be reunited with Eastern Ukraine. This would not only extend Soviet territory, but would steal the thunder of the OUN-UPA by giving Ukrainians the very thing they'd been fighting for. Any Poles living on the wrong side of this border would be expelled into Poland, and likewise Ukrainians on the other side of the border would be, quote-unquote, repatriated. To say this was a controversial solution at the time would be a gross understatement. For the Polish government in exile in London, the idea of changing the Ukrainian-Polish border so far westwards was virtually unthinkable. The border that the Soviets proposed was the so-called Curzon Line, which would see an area the combined size of all three Baltic states, Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania, severed from eastern Poland. The Polish city of Lwów would be awarded to Ukraine. Brest-Litovsk, given to Belarus, and Vilno, modern-day Vilnius, handed over to Lithuania. To agree to such a border would be effectively to endorse the Soviet invasion of Poland in 1939. On the face of it, the Western Allies were also opposed to such a solution. On the face of it, both Churchill and Roosevelt had previously expressed outrage at any suggestion that the Soviets should be allowed to hold on to this territory. And yet, both politicians were realists and knew that it would be virtually impossible to oppose Soviet plans now that they'd already occupied the whole region. The price of challenging Stalin over the issue was not one that either premier was willing to contemplate. Quote, "Do you want me to go to war with Russia?" said Roosevelt sharply when his ambassador to Poland suggested that America should stand firm on the subject. As early as November 1943, when Churchill and Roosevelt met Stalin for the first time at Tehran, they both indicated to him that they would not oppose his plans to incorporate the eastern borderlands of Poland into the Soviet Union. Churchill made no secret of this and tried soon after to convince the Polish Prime Minister Stanisław Mikołajczyk to accept this as a fait accompli, something that Mikołajczyk steadfastly refused to do. Roosevelt was more calculating, however, and didn't make his position clear until after he was reelected the following year, because he was relying on the support of millions of Polish-American voters. The final blow to Polish hopes on the subject came at the next meeting of the Big Three at Yalta in February 1945, when they jointly and formally declared that the eastern frontier of Poland should follow the Curzon line. The tragic thing about this process is that it was pushed through without any reference to the wishes of the Polish people themselves. Not even their elected representatives were consulted until after the deal had been struck in Tehran. And my interjection, tragic, certainly, but better deemed tragedy, perhaps, to help us better see the global statesmen and ourselves. Our lives under class, under the regime of rule, are truly sad. But our sadness is routine for power, if not for us, as we will never resign ourselves to its limits. Our lives under class are replete with the tragic, but arguably may be better seen as fragments of a massive, because unnecessary, tragedy. There's a great line in a wonderful film called Educating Rita, in which the professor of English literature explains to his class what distinguishes tragedy from the merely tragic is inevitability. Under class, the contempt that global statesmen have for us proceeds without cessation till we get clear on its opposite, on the opposite of power, of class, and therefore have the certainty we need to plan the end of this sick system.